This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. If you've lived in eastern North Carolina for any length of time, saying the word hurricane evokes memories of past storms like Floyd, Isabel, Fran, or Bertha. The powerful winds and torrential downpours during a hurricane can be stressful for native North Carolinians and downright terrifying for newcomers. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center have released predictions for the 2013 Atlantic hurricane season, forecasting an active or extremely active season. Meteorologist John Cole is with the National Weather Service office in Newport.
Some of the numbers that they put out were 13 to 20 named storms, 7 to 11 hurricanes, and 3 to 6 major hurricanes, and that would be hurricanes with sustained winds over 110 miles an hour.
Hurricanes are low-pressure systems in the atmosphere that rotate counterclockwise. Most hurricanes originate off the coast of Africa, generally out of an easterly wave. Approximately 100 waves come off the coast each season, and about 10% develop into tropical storms or hurricanes. Warmer than average water temperatures in the tropical Atlantic Ocean and Caribbean Sea, as well as the absence of hurricane-suppressing El Niño conditions, are some of the reasons why this year's season is likely to be more active.
We're expecting a more wetter and active West African monsoon. The upper-level easterly winds are expected to expand westward. We're expecting weaker trade winds. Those weaker trade winds don't allow for any shear in the lower levels. Also, there's something called an African easterly jet. That is expected to be in a favorable position for generating low-pressure areas off the coast of Africa.
Hurricanes are categorized to show the intensity of wind speed, central barometric pressure, and storm surge. The Saffir-Simpson scale is a 1 to 5 rating used to measure the hurricane's strength. It's used to give an estimate of the potential property damage and flooding expected along the coast from a hurricane landfall. A Category 1 or 2 hurricane is generally thought of as a weak hurricane, but in 1999, Hurricane Floyd produced heavy torrential rain in eastern North Carolina, dumping more rain on an area already saturated by Hurricane Dennis just weeks before. The rain caused widespread flooding over several weeks, resulting in 35 fatalities and about $4 billion in damages in North Carolina alone.
It was a Category 2 hurricane. It weakened when it made landfall. But then the rainfall effects inland along the river basins and in the river basins caused disastrous flooding, which could be compared to anywhere from a 100-year flood to a 500-year flood. It's that rare of occurrence.
Being prepared before a flood takes place makes all the difference. You can minimize flood damage by storing valuables in the attic or in a second story if possible. Keep household chemicals above flood level. Make sure that underground storage tanks are fully sealed and secure. Also, move vehicles, RVs, trailers, and lawnmowers to higher ground. During a flood, do not walk or wade through flooded areas. Be prepared to evacuate, and if you do evacuate by vehicle, don't drive where water is over the road. If your car stalls in a flooded area, leave it as soon as possible. Because homeowners insurance doesn't cover flood damage, consider buying flood insurance for your property.
The freshwater flooding effects can be very significant from even tropical storms. It doesn't take a major hurricane or a hurricane.
Just as dangerous as flooding, hurricane-force winds can blow over trees, knock down power lines, and destroy poorly constructed homes. North Carolina suffered significant wind damage when Hurricane Hugo struck the Outer Banks as a Category 3 storm in 1989. By the time it reached Charlotte and other inland areas, the storm had sustained winds of 69 miles per hour and gusts of 87 miles per hour, still strong enough to topple trees across roads and houses.
The wind effects to trees falling on homes can be extremely dangerous. Many people have lost their lives from trees falling on homes. And when you start seeing winds of 70, 80, 90, 100 mile an hour, trees can come down and you'll start to see significant structural damage.
After the back-to-back hurricanes Fran and Bertha in 1996, people began being proactive about taking trees out of their yard. Prepare your yard for hurricane season by examining trees for any signs of decay and weakness and have them trimmed or removed. To protect windows, homeowners can use plywood to cover exposed glass. A more permanent option includes installing impact-resistant windows or storm shutters. and high winds, anything left outside can become a flying object that can cause injury or damage. Put away any outdoor toys, furniture, trash cans, planters, or grills. Since eastern North Carolina is surrounded by large bodies of water, our geography makes us vulnerable to storm surge.
Surge, I think, is probably the number one threat to taking lives.
Storm surge occurs when water is pushed toward the shore by the force of wind swirling around the storm. In inland areas, storm surge could mean life or death. During Hurricane Isabel, storm surge caused extensive damage to homes and buildings in the Adams Creek area, where over 10 feet of storm surge from the Neuse River rose quickly, leaving residents barely enough time to evacuate their homes. Fortunately, during that storm, there were no fatalities.
It doesn't take a major hurricane to cause really disastrous storm surge. We saw that with Hurricane Isabel in 2003. We saw it with Hurricane Irene in 2011. So my advice would be to listen to the local elected officials. And if they advise evacuations or if they issue evacuations, then do so without hesitation.
The National Weather Service and National Hurricane Center use computer models to gauge the impact of storm surge on a particular area during a hurricane. A team of researchers at the North Carolina Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City have spent 20 years developing a computer model for measuring how the ocean moves. And since 2008, they've been using the technology to determine the impact from storm surge on an area as a hurricane makes landfall.
Our models then predict how the ocean's going to respond to these events, and not only how the ocean in its normal banks are going to respond to it, but once it overflows the banks and inundates the coastal areas, and as well as the estuaries and up into the, you know, some of the lower riverine systems.
Rick Lutick is the director of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Center for the Study of Natural Hazards and Disasters. He's also the director of the North Carolina Institute of Marine Sciences. Lutick says being able to measure the movements of the ocean allows them to warn people if they live in a vulnerable area and help them determine safe evacuation routes.
And then during an actual event or leading up to an actual event, we can give our best prediction as to how we think the response is going to occur, where the ocean's going to move to, and what areas are going to get flooded in the coastal zone.
The storm surge model, also known as ADSERC, was used by the Army Corps of Engineers to design and implement a hurricane protection system around New Orleans. It was also used by the National Flood Insurance Program to reevaluate risk maps. Lutick says the National Hurricane Center uses the ADSERC model, along with other computer models, to develop forecasts and issue warnings and alerts. The model results are updated twice a day and can be viewed online at coastalemergency.org.
They'll give you information on water level. If there was a storm out there that was going to cause some localized coastal flooding, you can see that. It also gives you information on wave conditions. And then when a major tropical cyclone is coming, then we shift over and run four times a day every time an advisory is released from the National Hurricane Center on the actual specifics of the tropical cyclone itself.
Whether it's storm surge models or hurricane warnings and watches, distributing information to the public is top priority during hurricanes or tropical storms. Local elected officials, weather service offices, the media, and county emergency management offices all play an important role in keeping the public safe. This week, Lee Jenkins examines how county emergency management helped keep the public informed before, during, and after a storm.
With hurricane season fast approaching, emergency management offices across eastern North Carolina continue to prepare for what experts say could be a particularly active season. Coastal and inland counties alike have begun updating modeling systems, checking equipment, and informing the public. According to Craven County Emergency Management Office Director Stanley Kite, ensuring they have top-of-the-line computer modeling systems that provide more accurate damage predictions, such as the HurriVac system, is one priority.
This modeling is supposed to be able to give us a better timeline of true live data or information from the storm and be able to put that back into a software program that will give us a better indication as to exactly how many residents or how many properties would be affected by storm surge.
This is especially important as Newman's location between the Neuse and Trent Rivers places it under heavy risk for storm surges. But in landlocked Pitt County, Director Noah Lee says spreading awareness via the media is one of their main focuses.
Currently, right now, what we're doing is trying to work through media outlets, different organizations, organizations in instructing people that they need to be prepared for this season.
Beaufort County also places a heavy emphasis on spreading awareness, but does so with reading material rather than through the media, explains Director John Pack.
We have been distributing various forms of literature, about 21,000 pieces of literature, through the schools, teachers at the school, to the students, and then also through our many senior centers throughout Beaufort County.
While the means of dissemination may vary, the information is similar. It explains where to purchase and stock disaster prep kits, discusses what insurance may be needed for certain regions, and stresses the importance of planning ahead. In any case, keeping citizens safe is the ultimate goal, says Carteret County's Deputy Director Joanne Spencer.
We just need to make sure that they have all the resources they need in order to make it through the season.
As a hurricane or tropical storm threatens to impact our area, still more preparations must be made. Each management office establishes and staffs an emergency operations center, some with as many as 26 active employees. Each operations center features a pre-stocked kitchen and sleeping facilities, as the flurry of activity these centers experience can last for several days. Carteret County also takes the time to pre-place aid in the more isolated parts of the county.
There's areas that can be isolated because of bridges, because of flooding issues, so we kind of pre-stage resources in those areas in case, you know, they are cut off and we can't get to them after the storm.
Craven County, on the other hand, learns as much as it can about the hurricane before it decides on a plan of action, as each hurricane can be vastly different.
Again, the storm will predict pretty much our action plan based on its travel and distance and time and expected time of arrival for impact of conditions.
These variable conditions make it difficult to determine when exactly the emergency operations centers need to be staffed. Between 12 to 14 hours before landfall, the offices issue evacuation notices. It's important to note that, while a recommended evacuation is just that, a recommendation, official evacuation notices are issued by local government officials. Even when notices are issued, the evacuation process is still tedious, primarily due to citizens' reluctance, as Craven County's Director Stanley Kite explains.
Typically and historically, it's been a slow process in the beginning, and the average rule of thumb, the citizens like to wait until they think the storm is much closer. And it's really difficult to encourage citizens to evacuate when the sun is still shining. However, to lessen the impact on them as individuals and lessen the impact on the local area, it would be much better for them to give themselves plenty of time to get out of the area that's going to be impacted by the storm and not get caught up in heavy, congested, clogged traffic or even deteriorating conditions.
As the hurricane wreaks havoc on the region, the offices essentially act as a nerve center, monitoring the storm, processing damage reports, and sending out first responders.
When winds exceed 45 miles per hour sustained, then we stop responding to calls because we are then placing the first responders in great peril.
Still, coordinating response to any immediate threats is the office's central duty during the storm, according to Spencer.
We are a coordinator. We provide resources that are needed throughout the county.
Once all of the data is gathered about damages, Pitt County's director, Noel Lee, says it's sent to the state, and then on to Washington, D.C., who determines if the damage is severe enough to warrant a federal declaration.
What we want to be able to do immediately after storm is to get a damage assessment so that we can try to build the amount of damage to the dollars to make us eligible for a federal declaration, which will allow FEMA to come in to help us.
Finally, the offices enter into the recovery process, working with state and local agencies to repair the damage as quickly as possible. According to Spencer, FEMA's service has been invaluable.
FEMA has been right here after the fact. I mean, as soon as the storm passes, they've had representatives here to assist with damage assessment, to assist with recovery efforts, with temporary housing or things of that nature.
Pitt County Director Noah Lee says they also rely on volunteer effort.
Then you have a lot of different non-governmental agencies such as the Baptist Men, some other agencies that may actually go out and help individual citizens. We try to work with them just to coordinate that, of trying to let them know what is the hardest hit areas.
Volunteers can hinder the recovery process just as easily as they can help it, according to John Pack, Beaufort County's director.
Sometimes immediately following a storm, everybody wants to volunteer and go to a certain part of, say, Beaufort County that was what they perceive as impacted the worst. So you could end up with 200 or 300 volunteers just showing up but no coordination as to what they're going to do.
So even in the recovery process, the individual county offices continue to work as a coordinating body with neighboring counties to determine how to most effectively use the resources they have at their disposal. I'm Lee Jenkins.
As emergency management officials across eastern North Carolina are hard at work keeping the public safe and informed before a hurricane hits, during the storm, and after it passes, your part in keeping your household safe is easy. It's time now to prepare by collecting supplies for your hurricane kit. National Weather Service meteorologist John Cole.
Canned goods, non-perishable items, any medicine that you may need, water for that 3 to 5 day period, plenty of cash on hand because the ATMs may not be working, gassing your vehicles, you know, things like that.
Other items to include are personal care items and, most important, a battery-powered or hand-crank radio so you can stay informed when severe weather strikes. To see a complete list of items for your disaster supplies kit, go to publicradioeast.org.
The Down East Journal on PRE Public Radio East is made possible by our members in partnership with Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, offering expert advice to assist in providing the proper foods and shelter for backyard birds during this nesting season. Wild Birds Unlimited, 2029 South Glen Burnie Road, New Bern, and online at wbu.com/newbern.
Hi, I'm Paula Poundstone, and I'm here to ask for your car. No, huh? Funny, that's what most people say. Until I tell them that it's for their favorite programs and that we can turn your old car into Morning Edition and wait, don't tell me. Ever see a used Ford Escort morph into Carl Castle? Pretty neat trick. Turn your car into the programs you love.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
Beaufort resident and Public Radio East commentator Joan Karras's children's books have touched on some lighthearted subjects. A Ghost of a Chance had a pair of friends searching for Blackbeard's treasure, and When the Boys Ran the House has four young boys taking care of household concerns when Mom gets sick. Joan's 2005 book, Wicked Water, has those light moments, but its setting will not go down as a light moment in the annals of North Carolina history. George Olson has this, which originally aired in May 2005.
It's not the fairy tale landscape one might expect from a book listed as for ages 7 and up.
Oh, look there! Grandpa's voice demanded attention. That's Kinston they're showing, right there, he pointed at the TV. The Lowes watched as murky water flowed down the highway on the edge of their hometown. The newscaster pointed out the Piggly Wiggly, one of their favorite grocery stores. Water lapped at its doors and windows. And we rode past this Kinston Hotel, another newscaster said, where water is nearing the second story. Truly a flood of epic proportions. She sounded absolutely delighted. Grandpa said, I'm almost past understanding. How could Kinston get all that water? He looked beseechingly at Dad. You're right, Trey. Maybe we're getting some kind of giant message.
There was very little fairy-tale-esque about eastern North Carolina in the aftermath of 1999's Hurricane Floyd. The numbers included in a book-ending Facts About Floyd page back that up. 51 people dead, 50,000 homes damaged, 217 caskets disinterred by flooding. The scene was grim, but a scene Joan hopes inspires discussions about how we live on this land among her young readers.
Dennis, and Floyd were bad facts, and I hope I've made them a little more palatable, but I really did want to explain what happens when nature gets out of control and when we don't respect nature's strength enough to plan wisely, build wisely, live wisely.
In an effort to make those bad facts more palatable, Joan's book presents one of the better stories from the flood, the efforts of the American Humane Association's rescue crews, which spent 2+ weeks in the Kinston area saving household pets stranded by the rising waters. The fictional story is told from two viewpoints. One, two children who with their family travel from their Kinston home for an out-of-state wedding, thinking the storm is over, and leave their pets behind, unaware of the flood to come. And two, the 10-year-old Mouse Cooper, who stows away on the Humane Association's big blue rescue truck when it heads to Kinston with his veterinarian father leading the team. and who is less than pleased when he discovers his son and makes his displeasure known in the chores Mouse will perform before he gets sent home to Colorado.
1. You will be based at the truck at all times. 2. You will clean out the animals' cages and pens. The animals we bring in are scared, and some are sick. Many have diarrhea. It will not be pretty work. 3. You will clean everyone's filthy gear at the end of the day. You will work in a dry suit so you don't get sick from the crud on our gear. You will sweat in that dry suit, I guarantee it. And while you sweat, we'll sleep. Dr. Cooper smiled. Ooh, nasty smile, Mouse thought. He looks like the Grinch.
The dry suits that Mouse will wear and that Mouse will clean is a crucial part of Wicked Water, somewhat of a symbol of just how nasty the environment was that the Humane Association and other rescue workers were working in during the aftermath of Floyd.
And the floodwaters have in them everything that was on the ground. It's dog poo, cat poo, fox poo. You know, it's not a cute mess. And it was one of the rescuers herself who said to me, "Ooh, that water is wicked." And that gave me the title for the book. So you wear this awful-looking orange dry suit, and it does keep you dry inside, but, oh, it keeps you hot.
And it was in this unhealthy swirl while wearing awkward dry suits that the Humane Association was able to rescue about 256 animals during their stay in Kinston. In this scene from Wicked Water, rescue workers Annie and Faith enter a flooded home to rescue 3 pit bulls.
Both of them studied the dim, far corner of the room. There, up high in a set of shelves, sat a skinny, quivering pit bull. He had crammed himself into a shelf above the water. Eyes wide, he stared down at them and shook all over. "Hey, fella," Faith said. "Good dog. How long have you been up there without food and water?" The pit bull blinked and tried to lick its lips. "You look awful thin," Annie said to the dog. "Okay, now this thing coming at you is called a capture pole. We won't hurt you, but we like it when you can't hurt us. So that's why we just slip this little noose." Oh, what a good dog. She let the noose settle gently on the dog's neck. A tiny sound came from the pit bull.
But that dog was the only animal to come out of the house. Jones says this was based on an actual incident, and as in real life, one animal came out alive, another was missing, apparently able to escape out a window whose fate was never discovered by the rescue team, and another was found dead, trapped in a flooded room with nowhere to escape from the rising waters. It makes for some relatively disturbing scenes, and added with the ecological issues underscoring Wicked Water, it can seem rather heavy for a children's book. But plenty of lighter moments are woven in to leaven the message, such as a scene from Wicked Water with Paisley and Davis, the 2 Kinston children who, with their parents, are unable to reach their destination or return home because of floodwaters. They find refuge at a Williamston-area farmhouse, and to pass time, they do a few farm chores for the Johnson family, which produce the honesty and a touch of cruelty that only a child can provide, and keeps Joan writing as well.
Walking tall, Davis strode into the chicken coop. "Good morning, ladies. I trust you've all been busy. Clucka, clucka." He shot one hand under the nearest chicken and came out holding a warm egg. With a regal nod of his head, he said, "The basket?" Resigned, Paisley held out the basket. It wasn't fair. All her life, he was going to be older by 3 years. Was he always going to be this obnoxious? Why couldn't she have been born into a family with just girls? Or been born first. At last he came to the fat white chicken that had stabbed Paisley only minutes ago. Down came the vicious yellow beak. "Stupid chicken!" hollered Davis, snatching his hand away. He stared down at the blood welling up in a red, round bead on the back of his hand. Paisley knew it was wrong. She'd probably go to hell for this, but she felt glad. It was Davis's turn to suffer. I love writing. I absolutely love writing stuff like this. I don't know what it is about writing children's literature that is so much fun, but that is what it is. It's very hard, but it's also a whole lot of fun. And when you do a part right, you know it's right. I have tried to gather eggs, you see, and had that exact experience. And I just got pecked to bits.
Joan Karras is a Beaufort resident and writing instructor. Her latest children's book, Wicked Water, is intended for ages 7 and up and is available from North Shore Books. I'm George Olson.
One update on this story, since the 2005 publication of Wicked Water, Joan has produced several more children's books, including her most recent, Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press. Thanks for listening to the Downey's Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features that you'd like to hear on the Downey's Journal, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.